Hey guys, Ogaro here.
Hi, Duncan here.
Yes, and we have something, we created something special for you. We created a podcast where we are sort of going to take you through our journey in BioFac. This year it was all an online event. Yep. And, you know, we set out to, you know, see what are some of the things we can pick from the conversation at BioFac. And we did attend some conversations, some sessions, and we picked a lot of stuff from those conversations. So we were sort of going to share with you in this conversation, and hopefully it will be something that will be of value to you and you can be able to use in your journey of looking and trying to understand the organic industry better. Just a quick overview about BioFac. This year it was an online event, completely online, First of its own. And it was the 31st edition of BioFac. So it's been, you know, going on for quite a while now.
Yep.
And the main objective of this BioFac was to shape transformations together. So the whole idea is about bringing people who have similar ambitions to work together, because one thing that we the current situation, the current pandemic has shown us that you can be isolated and expect to survive. So the whole idea was, how can we shape transformations together? I think the whole conversation in BioFac really encapsulated how different sectors, people who care about the environment, people who care about how the food is grown, people from the legal sector, people from the policy sector, how can all these people work together? I thought that was a very good topic to try and work around, because, you know, the current pandemic has shown us working together is actually the only option that we can do moving forward.
So
we, you know, we did go to a lot of sessions.
Yes.
And Duncan is going to share with you some of the things that we looked around and we saw, and then we're going to continue.
Just to quickly recap that, BioFac is sort of like this big event normally in real life. We sadly did not have the opportunity to go. Ogaro and myself, part of our master's degree, would have gone there. Sadly, we went there online, which was an experience, and it was interesting nonetheless. To be allowed to go there, we follow the course Moa Cafe, which is a course within our master's degree, and in the process of doing that, we were expected to sort of read into the topic a little bit. Now, obviously, organic production is quite a wide term. There's certificates, ideologies, arguably. Concepts of health, concepts of production that are all linked to this idea. So in that preparation, Ogaro and I split the work and read a couple of papers on different topics, because we're intrigued by the interaction of the pandemic with the topic of organic production, consumption, all of that, and how this could possibly be linked to coming out of the pandemic stronger or better.
Yeah.
You know, how it's influenced us and how we have to work together in the future. So in that process, I came across a paper by Vega Zamora et al. And she suggests that the promotion of further increasing organic production and health and life should be linked. And I was very intrigued by that. Health and life need to be linked. And I was like, okay, so that's interesting. So so she says that for organic production to create or to get more space in the market or to be more understood, maybe, I think is the suggestion made in that text, is that health and life should be linked as terms. And I'm very interested about that, because that would mean that health and life are equivocal to some extent.
Yeah.
I might be wrong in that. And I might have read into that a little bit there. But yeah, it's a very interesting suggestion. And then another paper... Rizzo in 2020, Rizzo et al, I should say, concludes that health is a key driver for most consumers to buy organic foods. Now, I thought that was very interesting, and I would want to understand better how accurate that is or not, because obviously it's an interesting claim to make that health is a key driver. Why is the key driver? Then I visited a document which was much younger, or older, I should say, the other way around, I'm saying it correctly. And that said that consumers need to have more information. And I think that's a trend which I feel I personally experience a lot when I'm talking on topics in the universities. We tend to say producers need to have more information, consumers need to have more information. And then there's the other side of the story. Goes. Right. There's the information overload. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, what was your findings from the research you did?
Oh, well, I looked at, the report, the World, the State of Organic report. They usually produces every BioFac.
Right.
So there are always new information that you can always get into. And, yeah, some of the top things that really came from that particular report is that the organic market is really growing very fast. And COVID had a really huge role to play in the growth of the organic sector. So overall, for example, in the the European Union, Germany still continues to be the largest share of the organic market, then followed by the United Kingdom, although they just left the European Union.
They left us behind.
When these statistics were taken, they were sort of considered to be part of it.
Right.
And France is also the third largest share of organic market in Europe.
Oh.
So very interesting dynamics there.
Yeah.
Will be interesting how the market shapes itself moving forward without the United Kingdom.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. So who will be able to step in and, you know, take that particular position?
Good question.
Also, the organic farmland in the European Union grew by 6%.
Okay.
Retail sales were also up by 8%. And the current organic retail sales are at 45 billion euros. So very great potential of growth there, especially now that, of course, we are in the pandemic and this that awareness of, what should I consume? What kind of food do I want to buy for my family? What kind of stuff? And I think organic has a huge potential there to tap into that particular market of, you know, as consumers try to ask the question, what is the best path that I can be able to take to have my healthy back? From the report also, we also have different statistics. For example, in Africa, right now we have 2 million hectares of organic farmland in Africa, over 850,000 producers in the whole Africa. And we see Tunisia, Tanzania, and Ethiopia having the largest share of organic market over there.
All right.
The overall organic market is still small, but there is huge, huge potential of growth. In terms of organic producers, we see Uganda, Ethiopia, and Tanzania having the largest share of organic producers.
Right.
Well, there was a presentation that was given by David Amdavi that I thought was very insightful, and it was about what are some of the opportunities that are actually available in the African continent from an organic perspective.
Right.
Rapid population growth. Right now, the African continent is at 1.2 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge mouth to feed. That means there's some organic market there that we can look into.
Right.
There's a lot of underutilized arable land that people can tap into. Global food consumption, and there's also the implementation of the Africa continent of free trade, where there will be open borders, similar like the European Union, where people can sell their products and move freely to do business. So there is a huge potential from an organic perspective to be able to enter that particular market. So this was some of the insightful things that, that book always offers, and mm-hmm. it's a very, very great book that I would recommend that everyone looks into to try and understand the statistics better,
right.
and to try and see how the organic movement sort of moves
right.
Forward from where we are right now.
Because it will move forward. That's unquestionable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. From the vibes that you could feel,
yeah.
the kind of conversation people having during BioFac,
yeah.
there is definitely, we can see that the only way we can go is up. So,
yeah,
yeah, very excited about that.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And yeah. I think that's also, it is a very interesting space. I mean.
Definitely.
You know, the interactions on a global level. And continental level are extremely interesting.
Yep.
With that in mind, obviously we did not go into the BioFac mindlessly.
Yep.
We talked about what we looked into,
yep.
And we sort of moved towards the BioFac with an initial question in which we said, to what extent could health be a catalyst for increasing the market share of organic products? Not specifically for a part of the market, but obviously just in a general sense, right?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, we did visit different lectures or event meetings. I don't really know how to title them.
Yeah, but, yeah. sessions. You can someone say those sessions.
Right, yeah. right. Yeah. yeah, so we joined these different sessions, like you were already explaining a little bit just now.
Yeah.
In one of those sessions, we ran into Thomas Roland.
Yep.
From Coop Denmark.
Yep.
Very interesting session.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gave perspective to how retailers look at the organic market.
Yeah.
Personally, I was intrigued. You agreed?
Definitely.
Yeah. So that sort of led us to sort of go, wait a minute, this might be an interesting gentleman to have a talk with.
Yeah.
And who might be able to inform us what the retailer's perspective is on how health could be a catalyst for increasing that market share for organic production, also taking into account, for example, the whole concept of who's responsible for what.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very curious about that. And then well, you agreed with that curiosity. And so we set out to email him, and he's been so delightful to say yes to that.
Yeah, yeah.
So with no further ado, I think it's time to introduce our special guest for today's podcast. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is a lot of, from the presentation that he made, there is a lot of insights that he will be able to offer into this particular conversation. So I will suggest people listen to it till to the end so that you can pick a thing or two from this particular conversation. I have a good feeling that it's going to be a good one.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
So, with no further ado, here's our expert of the day, Thomas Roland, who is the CSR manager for Coop Denmark. Thank you for joining us today, Thomas. I already mentioned your name, but we'd be curious to get to know you a little better. So, obviously, you work in Denmark, but are you from Denmark, or where are you from?
Yes, I am from Denmark and working from Denmark. And but I'm, you can say I have a outlook into the organic world in the sense that I've worked with the organic market and how consumers have been driving the organic market in something like 20 years now. So this has been my one of many fields, but one of my main fields in my work life since the year 2000.
Wow, that's a serious amount of time that you've been involved in this sector. Very interesting. So just out of interest, obviously we're doing this related to the master's degree that we're doing, which is the master's in organic agriculture, which obviously relates to the topic that you're having about. What background education have you done to get to where you are now?
Well, actually, my formal education is I'm a social anthropologist. And instead of going somewhere abroad and studying cultural behavior in a strange group of people, I've actually studied the interaction between customers and salespersons in shops. So you can say that I'm an anthropology in the same field that I'm actually working with today. So there's kind of a red line in what I've been doing, but I'm not educated in you can say farming or food or anything. What I'm educated to to work with and understand is actually behavior and why consumers do like they do.
Very nice. Interesting stuff. That's really exciting. So obviously you've explained in short that your job role is being the CSR manager, if I understood you correctly. Could you give us a bit of a description of what that exactly entails? What's your day-to-day like, but also in the more general sense, what do you are you responsible for an overall agenda for Coop Denmark?
Not the whole sustainability agenda.
The agenda. I can say we are a couple of colleagues more than just me working with the CSR, or corporate social responsibility agenda. But the interesting thing about working with sustainability in a company like ours is that I think in my job I try to find gentle ways to actually force my organization to move towards a more sustainable ways of working, a more sustainable pattern. You can say to drive change towards a more sustainable food system, in the sense that part of what I do is actually also trying to educate consumers. It lies in our foundation being a consumer cooperative, consumer owned cooperative company, that actually we rely on also educating and teaching, you can almost say, consumers, and we have then stretched that to school children as well. To tell them, explain them about the food system, how food is produced, also how organic foods differ from conventional food, etc. So that's another part of my job. You can say one part is within my company, trying to set up targets and measure whether we actually move forward on the targets that we've set. And on the other hand, working towards consumers, try to educate, inform, teach, what can they do to actually support a more sustainable food system through their choices.
Trying to regather what you've just said, if I summarize this correctly, a part of your job is what stood out for me actually is the fact you said that you've come to a level where you're educating young children in the process of your job, which I think is amazing. It's one of the things that we will obviously revisit later on when we've got more in-depth questions that we will ask you. To move on a little bit,
yes,
we want to get to know you a little bit better still, if that's okay. So I'm going to follow up with the next question. How did you get into this job? And what was the underlying motivation or passion, if there was? And how did this come about? So what was the reason to want to get into the job you're in, specifically promoting or being so involved with organic and arguably healthy?
Well, I think in many ways the organic food system is something that shouldn't actually be able to exist in a very highly competitive market situation like the one we have, right? Because it's actually producing more expensive products, and it's not necessarily following the same logic as all other development in the market has been following. You know, always seeking more efficiency to lower the prices and lower the costs. Somehow, the organic food system is a contradictory way of producing food, but it still exists on market conditions. To me, that represents a possibility of actually using, you can say, the market forces to drive changes towards a more sustainable system taken as a whole, because you have this alliance between producers and consumers that through the value chain are actually driving some change that's somehow financially, economically illogical. And that to me, I think, is really interesting. And that, I think, is why we can learn so much from the organic case on all the other areas in society as well.
Any reasoning do you think that is behind that, the drive, the organic sector existing despite not really making sense economically in the economic market?
Well, it ticks a lot of boxes, you can say, in modern consumers and what consumers are aware of or afraid of or what they dream of. It's a production where you can say that within the organic rules, so to speak, You work towards better animal welfare. You work towards minimizing use of pesticides and additives. You work with the old varieties, non-GM crops. So there's a lot of areas where you actually seem to tick some of the boxes that if you ask consumers just after they get up in the morning, what kind of production would you actually prefer, or how do you really want you food to be produced, then they will probably, most of them, describe something that looks like the organic food production. They want something that's clean, that's safe, that's even the animals are treated in a better way. That's really why I think many consumers want to support the organic production and buy organic products.
Yeah, okay.
Interesting. That's a very interesting perspective.
Yeah.
To revisit that just a little bit, how did you end up in this job? What was the path? Because obviously you were intrigued by this specific notion that you've just presented, which is, I think it's a very, very interesting notion indeed.
Well, my path is actually, if you want my full biography here, I think organic production has played a role in that, because...
Right.
My first job actually was in a, you could say, classic market analysis company, where I helped big companies in the food sector to, find out how to market new products. And that was just, when the first big companies like Arla and other big companies started to make organic varieties. So I've been actually from the very beginning of my career interested in how could you actually make that market grow? Then I switched horses, so to say, and worked in the Danish Consumer Council, which is a consumer NGO, for 7-8 years, where I actually worked with how you can interpret the consumer demands, you can say, for healthy and clean products into maybe also elaborating the organic rules. So that was actually my work for 7-8 years. And then after that, I moved on to you can say, the sector that actually provides the food, and not just discussing how it should be. And since then, I've been working in co-op and working with the suppliers, the organic producers, and our buyers, and the campaigns that we do towards consumers for promoting, for instance, organic products, but also other sustainability agendas.
Okay. Nice.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think just to connect with what you said earlier about consumers, organic not making sense from an economic perspective. On your presentation that you made during BioFac, you mentioned a little bit about it, about consumers wanting a climate label, but at the moment you're not in a position to sort of provide that kind of label. Can you sort of guide us through what are some of the challenges that you think goes through to provide such a kind of a label?
I mean, if we just ask our customers, then I think 70% of them will say, yes, please give us a climate label.
Yeah.
And but what we do is that we actually interpret that wish into help me being able to actually make some climate aware choices when I do my shopping. That's actually what this wish can be translated into. And the reason I think that climate labeling is very difficult is that, first of all, it's not very precise. I mean, how can you actually measure the climate impact from different production systems through these life cycle assessments? There are so many assumptions. And if you're going to incorporate what's called indirect land use change, change on arable lands, you asked why we couldn't provide a climate label. Well, it's not very precise. That's one thing.
Okay.
Secondly, the differences between products within a category is actually minor. You can take say pork meat, for instance, from the best pork meat to the worst pork meat, there's not much of a difference. What really, really matters is actually the difference between categories, between, say, meat categories and vegetable or plant-based categories. I mean, that's where the big differences are. And a label, on product label, will only or mainly work when people are going to choose between different products within categories. And then it won't really help them, because very, very soon they'll realize that all the cheese is red, all the red meat is red, all the vegetables are green. You know, that's common knowledge for the already climate-aware consumers. And that's the third reason why a climate label won't work, because labels work only towards consumers who are actually interested in the area that this label points out.
Yeah.
And the question about a climate-friendly diet, for already climate-aware consumers, they know what they need to do. I mean, they need to lower their meat consumption or animal-based consumption, and they're going to eat more plant-based products, and probably they're going to beware about food waste. To a large extent, a label will not help these consumers obtain knowledge that they do not already know.
Yeah.
And therefore, we don't think that a climate label will actually make a bit of a big difference if it was introduced.
Oh, okay. Makes sense.
Yep. Makes sense. So we've sort of quickly introduced you to the audience. Obviously, we've introduced ourselves earlier in the podcast to the audience, but obviously, we'll just quickly recap who we are to you, and then dive into the more in-depth questions now that we've had a general understanding of who exactly you are. So, in short, as we said when we opened the call, my name's Duncan. My colleague here, Ogaro, both of us are doing the Master's Degree of Organic Agriculture at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. In that, we are following a evening course, I should call it, I guess,
yep,
which is called Moa Cafe. And for that, we went to the BioFac. And one of the first things that we sort of set out to do, which also leads to my first more in-depth question, is to discover whether diet is being used as a tool for speeding up a broader market acceptance of organic foods. Which leads me to the question, do you think this is a fair question to ask, looking at the current European market situation? And if so, or if not so, then why?
Well, it's a tricky question to ask, actually, because if you you can ask it in a different way. What comes first? An organic basket from a consumer's point of view, that I fill it up with organic products, or an interest in health and the origin of my food? You know, to a certain extent, I'll actually argue that it's this general interest in health, general interest in where does my food come from, what processes has it gone through before it actually ended up in my basket, that drives the choice of organic products. So in that sense, it's fair to say that you can say that diets or a changing dietary habits will sometimes entail that people will end up choosing more organic products. But I'm reluctant to actually conclude the opposite, that just because you have a lot of organic products, will you then have a diet, or will your diet change? I don't know. It's very, very hard to say. One thing I can say, though, is that if you look at consumers with a very big organic basket, with a big percentage of what they buy on a daily basis that's of organic origin, and you look at the choices that they may make in their diet, it turns out that they're actually eating a healthier diet on a daily basis. They eat less meat, they eat more vegetables, they eat a bit less alcohol or drink a bit less alcohol. So, I mean, but does that relate to organic products or not? I don't know. But at least you can say both things exist on the same time, an awareness about a healthy lifestyle and more organic food products in that basket.
Hmm. I like that statement a lot. I think it's a very interesting scope that you've just sort of put towards that question, saying that on the one hand, there's something to be said for it, but negating it with the opposite is not equally acceptable as a hypothesis. Interesting.
No.
I think that's
You can also see when do people actually start putting more organic products in their basket. Well, they do that when they get their first child. I mean, this is really where most consumers get convinced organic consumers, because suddenly you're not just responsible for yourself and what you eat. You are responsible for someone else, a little child who cannot decide for himself or herself what she should eat. And therefore, you seek out products that are, as you can say, healthy, innocent, and secure, safe as possible, because that's what you want to give your child. And therefore, you can see that when people get their first child, the organic percentage of their shopping basket will actually skyrocket. And that's also why I think, you know, what comes first, it's probably some changes in circumstances around a family's life that comes to a certain place where you can say organic is the answer on the challenge that I'm facing right now.
So then, to recap that, it's a market pull versus a market push.
I mean, there's definitely a big market pull for organic products, but it's driven from consumers' awareness and seek to find, you know, the most healthy and the most safe products on the shelves. But of course, there's also a push, and that push comes from players like us, from supermarkets, from producers, our suppliers, in the sense that organic is also it's a fairly good deal for us to sell organic products, because it has a bigger price, typically maybe 10 or 20% more expensive than buying a conventional product, which means in the end that we'll get a higher turnover on selling an organic product on average than a conventional product of the same range, same size, same amount. And that is to some extent also a good business for us. And therefore, you also have a market push for actually broadening the organic basket, seen from our perspective as well. So there's pull and there's push.
I don't think those things ever can be fully separated, but it's interesting to see how the interactions are interwoven. Would you like me to ask the follow-up question? So building on that, I think the perspective there is very interesting, and I follow a similar logic, also having looked into the literature, because one of the bits of literature that I reviewed is from the earlier 2000s, where it seems that reporting is that consumers seem to be not as well or as broadly informed as would be necessary about the element of health and diet and how these things are interlinked. So with that knowledge, do you feel that the topic of corona or COVID, so this global pandemic, was adequately addressed during the BioFac, and how dietary choices could play a factor in that event?
I mean, at the event, of course, it was probably addressed in the sense that the whole event was a digital event. We were sitting safe at home, all of us. So it was a very different fare than what BioFac usually is.
Yeah.
But having said that, I think the COVID crisis has brought about some changes in customers' behavior that I think is interesting and may actually relate to organic products. First of all, I think the COVID situation has reminded a lot of consumers that we are part of nature. I mean, we are not somewhere outside nature. We are part of nature for better and for worse. And in that sense, maybe we should also be aware that we are responsible for how nature, recovers and behaves, in the sense that what should we choose on our plate will also play a role, sort of in a larger perspective of what kind of production system that we are supporting, what kind of countryside we are living in, etc. So sometimes I like to think that the pandemic reminds people of that. Then we can also see some interesting changes in actual habits and buying behavior among consumers, in at least in the first months of the pandemic, of the lockdown last spring. Suddenly people were working from home, and we saw, you know, a lot of people taking up baking, for instance. And they've been used just buying, going to the bakery and buying a loaf of bread in the morning. Now they had to bake themselves. And what should they choose when they want to bake themselves? Of course, they want organic flour to do to make, because they want to make the best possible bread, right? So we had a very, very steep rise in the sales of organic baking products. So even though, I mean, a lot of people were shopping in supermarkets, buying more stuff in supermarkets as the restaurants were closed and the workplaces were closed, they bought even more organic than conventional products, probably out of this awareness of, well, it's a situation here that we are not really in control of. We might at least lower the amount of risks that we are running on our day-to-day, on our daily grocery shopping. And maybe we can do that by choosing more organic products. At least that's one way you can predict it. We haven't asked consumers, so I'm not actually able to tell if that's what's going on inside the brains of the consumers. What we can see is that just that the turnover of organic products rised even more than the turnover of conventional products when the corona crisis hit us.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that, because on BioFac as well, we had a presentation from the United Kingdom about how the organic market has grown during the COVID crisis. And the way you've pointed out that there was a decrease in terms of the amount of organic products that have been baked, actually reduced, because they also hypothesized that a lot of people were doing their home baking products. So yeah, for some reason we can sort of see and connect how that data relates from one area to another. It might not necessarily be in the same location, but you can see there's a sort of trend happening in that particular segment of the market. So it's a very interesting observation as well.
That very nicely builds on one another. It's as if the one part of that niche is having to take the hit for another niche growing.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see those things interact. I would like to move on to the next question, also with the frame of time in mind. Not that I want to rush through the topic, because I think we could all talk about this probably for hours. Yeah. But yeah, looking at the next question and the organization that you, or company I should say, that you work for, you will have undoubtedly dealt with diet and its catalyst effects on behavior in people. You would agree with the fact that diet is a catalyst? Yeah. So being the second largest retailer in Denmark, what have you observed as to people finding it hard to change habits? What's one of the intrinsic triggers that you've come across that you'd say this is something that we are struggling to counter or challenge?
Well, it always is already set in the word habit. What is a habit? I mean, a habit is a routine action that you actually do to save energy, to save mental energy, to not think about what you're doing. Then you can use your mental capacity on something else. So habit is actually what you're doing on a daily basis to save your mental capacity to something else that's more important to you. So therefore, it is really, really hard to change people's habits, because they are hidden in some sense. It's tacit knowledge. It's in the hands and fingers of people, and it doesn't necessarily need a calculation in the head to happen. What you're doing in the kitchen, for instance, how you do your cooking, etc. So that's why habits are so difficult to change. And also another reason is when it comes to food habits, I think, is that food plays so many different roles for us as individuals. Sometimes it's just fuel I need under my way to work or whatever. Sometimes it's a basis for a social occasion, a fiesta or whatever. Sometimes it's just a meal in the family. sometimes it's comforting food, you know. And in that sense, the way we use food is very personal and it's very different, and it's very hard for us as a retailer, for instance, to point out any of these reasons and then hit bullseye in something that people relate to. And therefore, we very often find ourselves only talking about the products instead of actually talking about the occasions or the habits in which people are transforming these products into meals, fuel, social occasions, whatever. Because it's we are on a ground that's hard to predict if we go that far. So therefore, we very often stay in our comfort zone and just talk about our products. That's
right.
It.
Right. Very interesting. That's interesting because if I look at, for example, Dutch marketing with regards to food campaigns, if you will, from large retailers like Albert Heijn, which might be a name that rings a bell. They very much build on the concepts of cultural consumption behaviors, such as Easter or St. Nicholas, and they really promote foods around that. And what I find personally interesting is that there seems to be no self-censorship on the kind of product that's being advocated for, which I think is very interesting, because I think that might present a possible opportunity to take that part of responsibility, which then also brings me to my question. Right. So building on that thought pattern, one of the things that personally, I don't know how much you've run into that, Ogaro, but one of the things that I personally found interesting is that there seems to, when we very often talk about the topic of diet, be this circular debate on who's responsible for what end. To what extent are retailers responsible for advocating the consumption of goods that are arguably healthier, right? The healthier choice. And where does that fine line lie? And how much of that process is the task of the consumer? What's your take on that, being obviously involved in one of these big retail companies?
Well, it's tricky. If we want to play the role, as you can say, nudging consumers to make more sustainable or more healthy choices, we can do that, of course. We know how to sell a bit more of a product compared to another product, depending on how we position it in the supermarket, on the shelf, or on the aisles, etc. But if we deliberately take away choices from consumers, also, for instance, removing the less healthy choices or the non-organic choices, you create opposition. So we have a very fine line actually to work on, or to balance on, because it's we can point out alternatives. We can have some, if we market a product, we can also market a different product with a different health profile, or maybe an organic version of that product. And we can make sure that we do that at the same time. But it's hard for us to, you know, edit too firmly in our assortment and remove things, because then you create opposition, and you just realize that your consumers end up shopping somewhere else. So it's tricky. It's tricky, I'll say.
Yeah.
But of course, we are aware that, that we can influence people's choices by presenting things to them, by using what you refer to as nudging in the shops. We call it space management and has done for years, but it's basically the same. It's knowing how to organize a shop so some products will have a higher probability of ending up in a basket than other products.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah,
I like that. That's a very. I also like that is something which personally, obviously, I'm mentally aware of the fact that wherever you deprive, you know, a consumer or customer of your business from something, somebody else will fill up that void. That's inevitable. But yet, when you realize that on a grander scale, like the one we're talking about now, it can be challenging to really give that a clear sort of frame as to how influential that is for retailers to make that decision. Which
not many retailers dare to take that first step and really say we want to we ban this product.
Right.
It's gonna get out of our supermarkets because we it doesn't tick the boxes that our CSR strategy. Not many consumers or retailers would do that towards their consumers because of the fear of the market, you can say. But but slowly we see more and more areas where we can actually where we are brave enough to actually do something a bit in that direction. One area is, for instance, eggs from caged hens.
Right.
We banned that completely. You can't find it in any of our supermarkets. One of our supermarket chains, based in mainly around Copenhagen, we are discussing now whether we should actually, get rid of all the conventional eggs, maybe even the conventional milk, because 85% of what these shops sell is actually organic. So maybe it's about time that we actually make the choice for the consumer on these areas. There's a lot of vegetables, you can say, some vegetables that are not that common. Should we really have a conventional and an organic version of that less, you can say, turnover vegetables? No, we shouldn't. Maybe we should just have the organic version of that, because it can fill in more shopping baskets than the conventional. You can find that in more shopping baskets than the conventional products. So in that sense, we are slowly moving towards a more organic assortment. I will not say necessarily towards a more healthy assortment,
right.
Because we, when it comes to health on a product level, we also have the high fat version still on the shelves, but we might have the organic version of that as well.
Right.
Yep.
That's a very interesting point, because it sort of comes to the whole concept that even with the figures in favor, it still takes a bit of guts and brass to actually make that cutting decision to say, and now
it does,
get rid of it. So again, I feel like there's this underlying clinch on the concept when you again present the fact that we still have the fat intense products lying there, that health still has this potential to be more seriously maybe, or more effectively challenged. But who would you say has a role to play in that?
The challenge is that health is not a very strong driver in people's buying decisions, really.
Okay. Right.
It's taste, you know. I want to buy something that I'm sure my family will like. And if my wife or husband or whatever has a condition, yes, maybe then I'll change, you know. I'll skip the butter and buy some plant-based spreadable product with a better fat content, something like that. But it's to sort of the general public do not necessarily go into the shop with this health perspective in mind when they're doing their daily shopping. So therefore, it is very difficult for us. And also, as I said previously, they do not necessarily have the same idea about what is actually a healthy product. What's a healthy lifestyle? It varies a lot from person to person. And right now you can say you can at least identify three or four different health lifestyles. I won't say that they are competing with each other, but they are present there at the same time. We have some consumers who are sort of defining a healthy choice as the traditional low-fat, low-sugar choice. Mm-hmm. There exists labels pointing that these kind of products out. Then you have you can say body aware consumer that look on food items as fuel for their body, and they want to find the best proportion of different ingredients to support their machine and make it even higher performing, and then they will think a healthy product will be one with a high protein content, for instance, or whatever they can read into it. Then you have a more scared segment, maybe you can say, a segment that will navigate in avoiding things, avoiding certain ingredients, avoiding something which I think gives them allergies. So this is a free from movement, And then you can say the last one, which is growing in number right now, is actually someone who looks upon a healthy lifestyle as a happy lifestyle. I mean, we don't necessarily just want to live long lives, but we want to live meaningful lives as long as we live. Right. And that means that in their perspective, a glass of wine is fine. I mean, because it comes about, it's what you enjoy in a social situation among friends, and that's also part of a healthy lifestyle in their perspective. And therefore, it is really, really difficult for us to communicate in health or say something is healthier than something else, and then reach all our customers, because all different kinds of notions of what health means exists out there among the consumers, and we need to be able to embrace all of them.
Right, yeah, without question. Otherwise, again, the competitor will fulfill the void.
Yeah,
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 that
sure.
makes total sense. Yeah. Such interesting insights. So I'm looking at you, Garo, of the residual questions, because I think we still have three of them that we've not really touched upon yet. Is there one that stands out that you'd still like to ask?
Not necessarily. I think he has done a really good job in terms of covering most of the questions that we heard. Mm. So, yeah, I wouldn't say I have something to add, but it was an interesting point that you mentioned in one of your locations, and I think in Copenhagen, 80% of your product, for example, are organic. So what was the driver for you to get up to 80%? Was it from the consumer's perspective, or was it from your own initiative?
I tend to say that it's the consumers who are driving that change, actually. Of course, we need to provide a variety of organic products on the shelves, but we cannot do that without having some customers in the shops that have a preference for organic products. So, and it's only in certain categories of products that the percentage is that high. It's something like drinking milk or maybe eggs. If you go to something like wine or beer, the organic percentage in the same shops may be 10 or 15%. So it's not like the whole shop is 80% organic. It's more like some areas, some categories of products will be more organic than other categories. And that relates specifically to consumer behavior. And you could say the products that turn organic first in the shopping baskets of most consumers, it's actually very basic products. It's milk, it's eggs, it's carrots, it's apples, it's oranges. It's some very basic products. And then later on in filling up the organic baskets, you can say some consumers are then starting to buy something like bread or minced meat or maybe even charcuterie, sausages, stuff like that. Yeah. And then only after having chosen organic in all these categories, then they start also to choose, say, organic sweets and liquors and ice creams, etc. That's really the few of the consumers who have that high an organic percentage that they manage to walk all the way up the ladder.
Yeah, nice.
Interesting.
You also mentioned, I think this will be a good thesis to sort of carry on later.
Mm.
You mentioned about individuals starting to sort of consume organic when they get a child. Mm. So, yeah, that will be a good research proposition, I think. Mm. What is the proportion of people who, when they have a child, that's when they start to care about organic in the long term?
Well, in the Danish organic market is very big in the sense that 16% of what we sell now of food products is organic.
Yeah.
But it's actually bigger if you look upon it from the consumer's perspective, because 85% of our customers, they buy at least one product category organic always when they go to the shops. So in their mind, you know, they are already an organic consumer. Yeah. 85% of all the consumers in this country, they look upon themselves as pro-organic, or at least they buy one category of products organic. So you shouldn't, I mean, it's only seen from our, you know, number space that 15, 16% is the level we reached. Seen from the consumer's perspective, it's a lot higher, because the organic products, they mean a lot more to people than the non-organic products. So it fills their mental shopping baskets with a higher number than 15 or 16%, if you can say it like that.
Yeah, nice. Another question, sort of follow-up. You also mentioned you are big in technology in terms of trying to use data to analyze how your consumers work. So from your perspective, how much do you think that has a role to play in changing the consumer behavior? And have you been able to pick some of the technologies that maybe you think have a very huge potential in when you look into the future of organic as well?
Well, yes. As I've already said, it's very hard to change people's habits because habits is what you, that feels like doing something downhill. You don't have to think.
Yeah.
But if you use technology and you use it cleverly, and you, for instance, analyze the shopping behavior of your customers, then you'll actually be able to, through technology, through the smartphone they have in the hand or in the kitchen when they're cooking, to give them, you know, an instant availability of ideas, of tips and tricks, maybe of offers and suggestions adapted to their consumer behavior. And if you use these kind of tools, digital tools, I'm sure you can use that for selling more organic products or helping people to choose more climate-friendly diet, for instance. You can use the technology, so to speak, to lower the bar or lower the energy needed from a consumer's perspective to actually change a habit.
Yeah.
So in that sense, yes, definitely.
Any technology you're looking at, any specific technology that you think might play a big role moving forward?
I mean, it usually when we have seen dietary changes on a larger scale in society, it's been driven by kitchen technology. When the refrigerator came, when the freezer came, when the microwave came, you know, it changed what people were eating and how they were storing products. I'm not sure it's going to be at kitchen technology that transforms it this time. I think it will more or less be our smartphone. It will be this self-scan or self-awareness that I'm getting as a consumer, as being able to, you know, track my steps or my fitness habits or whatever. Why not also use that kind of technology to be more aware of your habits as a consumer? So I think this is a good, this is one way at least to use technology. Another way is, of course, our use of smart data, of knowledge about people's habits and their the different buying behavior, and then trying to, you know, smartly use that information to target them with certain marketing efforts, etc. That also happens all the time, and you can just ask Google or Amazon or whatever they do it. That's a whole business model based on that kind of insights. You should just also be able to use that power to drive changes towards a more sustainable, more organic, and more climate-friendly consumption pattern, I think.
Okay. Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
I think one last rounding up question, and then we'll end it there. Although, again, we could probably talk to you about this topic for hours, and your answers have been very insightful. If you look at where we stand now on organic as a food type, how do you think we need to move forward from where we are now on a, let's say, political, institutional level, on a personal level, and to make sure that organic products have a larger market share in the broadest sense?
Well, I think you should keep making product innovations in companies, in organic, among organic producers, suppliers. You should also, as a company, maybe set targets, set public targets. I mean, we have a target saying that we want to see our organic turnover grow by 60% from 2020 to 2025, for instance, 60% higher. You should also work with the prices. I mean, if you can lower the prices and get some economy of scale going, maybe you should invest a bit in that. And then only after having, I mean, a larger turnover, you can sort of harvest again. That, I think, is a good way of doing it. Also, you should, I think the organic sector should embrace something like climate change and biodiversity a lot more wholeheartedly than maybe what's right now present in the organic rules or principles. Climate change and loss of biodiversity will be main awareness areas for consumers in the next decade and probably many decades to come. And organic producers need to have the right answers to that problem on a local but also on a global level. And then I think what you can learn from the Danish example is actually that there's been always a very close dialogue in the whole food chain, in the whole value chain, including the politicians, authorities, and all the commercial players, to remove obstacles. I mean, to make common action plans, to make common campaigns about what organic food choices can actually have, what kind of effect they will have. So in that sense, it's really much a question of working together in the whole value chain.
Yeah.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
That's an interesting outlook, and I think that's something that we will be able to take along with ourselves after this interview. Yeah. Thank you for making time to talk to us today. It's been extremely insightful. We've very much looked forward to doing this interview, and it's been everything and more than what we could have expected from it.
Yeah.
Right, thank you so much for your time. And
you're welcome.
Yeah, we'll maybe meet sometime in the future again.
Yes, maybe in the physical world sometime, yeah, when
that
it's open
nice.
Again.
Maybe
thank you very much.
Right, bye-bye
Thank
now.
You very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Yeah, see you.
So, that conversation
yes.
with Thomas, that was something, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely something. I mean, it's not often when you speak with someone you get to pick a lot of things that they say, but you can see from the conversation he has been in the industry for such a long, long time, and he has data on his fingertips on how he perceives things. So I guess that perspective also helps him to answer questions, you know, very straightforward and gives a very detailed information about a particular question. So that was an intriguing angle for me. And one of the things I picked out was when he mentioned health is really defined in so many terms.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a very straightforward way of defining health.
No.
So health, for example, for one person can be physically how do I look, and then when I'm eating something, what do I want to get from it? I just want to get calories from it.
Right.
You know, very specific. I want to build my body, and that is it. And
engine
then,
fuel.
I need fuel for my body. So there is no standard way of defining health. And then for me, from that definition alone, that's where we get different variations of what health actually means. So if you're to go into the street and ask someone, what does actually health mean to you? Mm-hmm. If you ask 100 people, you're probably going to get 100 definitions.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, so, depending on, you know, from where I come from, I had a very clear and specific way of defining health. But after this conversation, so it's sort of expanded my idea of what health actually means, which is, a good perspective to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's interesting. And I very much like the way you recap that, because I feel very much the same way that from my personal perspective, it's also so funny to realize that it's sometimes very simple in your own head to think there's one way that is. And it was the same when for example, from my one of the big takeaways for this conversation was him mentioning how whenever they make the definitive choice for the consumer by taking away a product, it does not actually take away the consumer's choice or option, because there is, without question, going to be a different company that comes in and says, fine, if you're not selling that, we'll sell it.
Yep.
So it's interesting, because you get this sort of chasing your own tail situation where you might want to advocate, you know, an arguable or arguably better way of consuming, or a more sustainable way of consuming, by advocating organic organic products.
Yep.
Which, you know, I think both of us were interested in that unquestionably. Yep. And then there is the side of market reality, which sort of slaps us around and goes, wait a minute, great that you want to help in the promotion, but what about everybody else in this market?
Yeah.
And I like that a lot. So, yeah, I thought that was a very interesting takeaway. And combining that with health not being a one specific denominator, who do you think could play a role in helping to define that?
Yeah, and I think that ultimately goes to individuals on how they define, you know, health. And and that helps us to have responsibility on ourselves on how we act. You talked about forming habits, which is something a lot of us, especially me, have tried forming different habits. It's not been easy. So I can relate how hard forming habits are. And if we are to create a healthy society, it has to come from our own desire of actually wanting to be healthy, wanting to create a better habit, a healthy habit for ourselves. So ultimately it has to start by ourselves. And he mentioned in the conversation also, he realizes that them as a corporation, they have a role to play. He mentioned about space, something about space, how they arrange certain products in a supermarket plays a role on how people purchases products. Also that has a role to play, but ultimately it comes to us. So imagine I as a consumer being informed on what I want to buy. So when I get out my home and I'm going to the supermarket, I know exactly when I get to the supermarket, I want to buy organic eggs, organic milk, organic bread, and then I come back home. So we make our choices very, very easy.
Yeah.
And these guys, as you mentioned, they are monitoring our data, what we are doing when we enter into the supermarket.
Right.
And that translates in the long term how they behave towards us as consumers. So in the long term, they can see, hey, a lot of people are buying a lot of organic products from supermarkets. How about we have more products on our shelves that are organic? So individuals, consumers have a big role to play, in my opinion, and that has to be on the top. Of course, we ourselves, we need some pillars also to help us in transforming that healthy lifestyle, and that's where corporations them can come in. Sometimes governments can come in terms of creating better laws of ensuring people can live healthy lives, but that comes at the bottom, in my opinion. At the top, it has to be on our own resilience. How bad do we want to actually live a healthy lifestyle?
Right.
Yep.
Right. That's a very interesting point, and I see what you're saying, and I think that is going to be a very, I don't disagree with it by that. Yep. By all means, let that be very clearly said. I do think it's going to be very challenging. So, what you're saying, accurate in my perception. Not in any way disagreeing with how we as consumers are going to have to carry that responsibility. Having said that, with that part of responsibility, one of the things that we discussed in the introduction as well a little bit is how information as a consumer, it's nearly as challenging as when you're a university student who gets bombarded with all this literature and you're like, this is good, that is good. And being a critical thinker, right, in the 21st century is pretty much a must. And I don't always know if it's a realistic expectation. So it's sort of, I feel like there's a disconnect there, and I'm very, very curious to see that space develop, especially because these larger corporations have access to this massive data. And I completely agree with you that habitual behavior is key to success effectively always.
I liked his definition of habit, of having to do something without having to think about it.
Right.
Because you want to use that energy of thinking to doing something else.
Yeah, I think actually neurologically, that's actually how it defines. I remember reading a book called The Idiot Brain. It's not a joke, that's the actual title of the book. Written by Dean Burnett, he's a neurologist. Very funny, hilarious book. Yeah. And I think he actually says when we're young, we actually experience days to be very long because we're still learning so much. So it's much more of uphill cycling, whereas the older we get, it's more downhill because we've already figured out how the tricks work. So it's yeah, I like that as well. It's a nice reference.
Makes sense, yeah.
But yeah, we have to round this up. Otherwise, we're going to be talking about this until the morning.
For sure, for sure.
So yeah, yeah, thank you. This was awesome.
Yeah, yeah, I loved it. It was worth it. It was worth the wait.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we planned this for quite a while, and he was very gracious enough to give us his time. Absolutely. And yeah, I'm sure people have learned a lot from these conversations. There are so many views and angles that he gives to the conversations. So yeah, for me, it's been a pleasure having this conversation.
Likewise, likewise. And I liked what you said with that master thesis topic.
Yeah.
That's a good point, eh?
Yeah, interesting angle.
Yeah.
When people have kids, they tend to think, or tend to prefer organic more.
Right.
Makes sense. There was also a controversy that happened in China.
Okay.
In the 2008, 2009 of milk being underpowered in China. That helped boost organic movement in China.
Massive,
back then. So there's, I think there's something happening in the organic space, in the organic food industry that needs to be monitored a little bit better.
Right.
And it's an interesting segment to look forward to.
Yeah. So to anybody listening, if this topic interests you, that is an interesting research question for your thesis.
Definitely.
Right.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Till next time, guys. See you.
Bye-bye. Bye.